This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morrell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
Brian Fogel is an American filmmaker. He is best known for his 2017 documentary film Icarus, which won the 2018 Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature and which was instrumental in the International Olympic Committee's banning of Russia from the 2018 Winter Games. Brian is now releasing his most recent film, The Dissident, which chronicles Saudi Arabia's 2018 assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our sponsor. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is an episode of Intelligence Matters Declassified, Real Spy Stories, in this case told by an investigative filmmaker.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Brian, welcome to Intelligence Matters. You're the first filmmaker that we've ever had on the show, and given the subject matter, it is great to have you with us. So welcome.
Well, thank you, Michael. I've listened to you many times and honored to be with you and discussing a story that has so much importance in our world.
So, Brian, I just want to make sure you know that we have two different kinds of episodes here on the show. One, as you might expect, are national security experts talking about some particular topic. And a second type are former intelligence and law enforcement officers who are telling true spy stories that either they were involved with or that they witnessed during their careers. And we call that second type of episode Intelligence Matters Declassified. That's how I think of this episode, even though you're not obviously a former intelligence or law enforcement officer. And I think of it as an Intelligence Matters Declassified because the story that you tell in your new film, The Dissident, is a true story of a covert intelligence operation. It's just not one that is particularly positive. So let me start, Brian, by asking you to just tell our listeners what The Dissident is about.
Well, the Dissident is really, as I look at it, is the untold story, a thriller behind the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post Saudi journalist that walked into his country's consulate in Istanbul on October 2nd to be brutally murdered and dismembered while his fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, waited for him for marriage documents.
And she waited for him for quite some time outside, and he never came out.
It is exactly. And, you know, it's a story that I think I'm sure many of your listeners will recall and that just, you know, captivated the world in its brutality, in its kind of ripped from the pages, rendition gone horribly wrong, and all of these spy and intelligence thriller aspects to it. And of course, you know, in the tremendous loss, I mean, the unfathomable loss to Hatice Cengiz, who literally believed that he was walking into a consulate to get paperwork to marry her, to then find out in the days that followed what had happened to the man that she loved. And of course, there were many other threads to this story that the film, The Dissident, gets into and uncovers and unravels. But the core of the story is the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the why, the how, and really shedding light onto what is happening in Saudi Arabia.
So, Brian, when and where can folks see the film?
Well, the film is coming out in limited theaters, you know, with COVID and cities where theaters are available December 25th. But it will be available across all video on demand platforms January 8th. So whether that's Comcast or DirecTV or on iTunes, you know, Apple, or for rental on Amazon or Roku or Xbox, basically anywhere that you can go to rent a movie, The Dissident will be available beginning on January 8th.
So, Brian, I was lucky enough to see the film. I watched it a week ago, and I have to tell you and my listeners that it is one of the most powerful documentaries that I have ever seen. It is riveting, chilling, tragic, infuriating. I can actually go on and on and on. It unleashes a host of emotions. So from an investigative journalism and storytelling perspective, I wanted to just say a huge congratulations to you and your team. And that kind of leads me to ask, what led you to do this film? You know, why did you choose this topic at this time?
You know, my prior film, Icarus, as you may recall, unraveled the decades-long Russian doping scandal that basically, right, you know, cheated international competition and the Olympics, you know, for decades. And in that story, I ended up protecting the life of Dr. Gregory Rodchenkov, literally bringing him to the United States, working with him as we brought the story to the New York Times, and then following that story as it unfolded and his evidence was corroborated over the year that followed. That film, which launched on Netflix in August of 2017, 5 months later, led to the banning of Russia from the 2018 Pyeongchang Olympic Games. And in March of 2018, I was humbled by being awarded the Academy Award for the work of that film. Right. And, you know, coming out of that experience and every minute, every time that I'm able to connect with Gregory Rodchenkov through his legal counsel or through his security, the conversation always talks with, "Hey, Gregory, how are you?" And he goes, "I'm alive, Brian." And I said, "That's great." And he goes, "You know, you saved my life." And, you know, shouldering that responsibility or burden. And in the case of Gregory, he remains a whistleblower in hiding with a target on his back for the rest of his life as Putin will continue to hunt him. It gave me a feeling of a burden and a sense of responsibility to keep telling stories that I felt mattered. And in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, what I saw was complicity, essentially, with every government in the world continuing to do business with Saudi Arabia and the kingdom, despite these horrific human rights abuses. What I came to learn in seeking distribution for the film, where, of course, I would have wanted the film to be on a global streamer, after, you know, an incredible response at the Sundance Film Festival that included, you know, Hillary Clinton there and multiple standing ovations and wonderful critical reception, was that every one of these huge global media companies, streaming companies, were more concerned about their business interests with the kingdom and being able to take investment from the kingdom than they were in the, you know, horrific record of human rights abuses that has happened in Saudi Arabia under the watch of Mohammed bin Salman, and has continued to unfold, you know, during his time as the crown prince. And so, you know, these kind of factors that happen, I guess, compel me to want to tell stories like this. You know, I decided essentially in mid-October, as Saudi Arabia had in fact admitted that Jamal had in fact died inside that consulate, I thought to myself, this might be my next film. And that hinged on what I considered these three variables, which was having the exclusive access with Hatice Cengiz, being able to have exclusive access and participation with Omar Abdulaziz, the young Saudi dissident who had been working with Jamal at the time of his death, and perhaps most importantly, the Turkish government.
Right.
They would trust me and work with me to provide the, you know, behind the scenes evidence and information and details and interviews and surveillance footage and transcript of this crime so that I could, you know, craft this film.
So, Brian, let me ask you about the reaction of the large global platforms that you talked about. Do you think that they were actually under pressure from Saudi Arabia not to distribute your film, or was that a calculation on their own part of not wanting to upset the kingdom?
You know, it's hard to assess what was going on behind the scenes. However, you know, as we know, I think it was about a year ago, Netflix decided to pull Hasan Minhaj's Patriot Act episode out of Saudi Arabia. The episode, Hasan Minhaj basically dissected the Khashoggi murder and poked fun of MBS. Netflix was asked by the kingdom to take that episode off the air, and they did. And when asked about it, the CEO of Netflix came forward very publicly and said, "We're not a truth to power company. We're an entertainment company." So, you know, and then there's been further stories written that there were other compromises and kind of negotiating terms made between the streamer and the kingdom to keep other content on the air there. So, you know, I do believe that, you know, between the hundreds, perhaps billions of dollars a year that Saudi Arabia spends in lobbying efforts in the United States, many of these stories have emerged in the fallout of a Khashoggi murder, be it McKinsey, the consulting firm, or, you know, the story in The Guardian and CNBC of how Saudi Arabia is actively retaining all sorts of lobbyists right now, knowing that the Biden administration will not be as friendly to the kingdom as Trump, that you have to believe that there was either direct pressure or soft pressure campaign being launched by the kingdom or its lobbyists to see to it that this film did not find, you know, a big home among one of the major global streamers.
Yeah. You know, in your mind, this is your discussion about your previous film and this one and the link between the two. In your mind, they come together in my mind in a slightly different way. You know, I'm not sure if people realize how unique it is for a country to do what the Saudis did here, right? Which is essentially to assassinate in a brazen way a journalist, a citizen, but somebody who's a resident of another country the way they did. And there's really not too many leaders in the world who operate that way. And Vladimir Putin, right, is actually one of them. So in my mind, these two stories come together in a different way than they've come together for you. And I just wondered how that strikes you.
Well, I mean, you're spot on in this assessment. And, you know, I don't believe that Jamal Khashoggi would have been murdered, especially in the way that he was, had other authoritarian regimes, you know, meaning if you look at the Putin playbook, right, just in this latest poisoning of Alexander Navalny, the opposition leader in Germany, you know, many things you can glean from this. First of all, is while there might be a global, you know, universal, I guess what you would call a smack on the wrist for crimes such as these, it's not like any member of the G20 is actually enacting sanctions, actually taking action outside of the Magnitsky Act, which Bill Browder, I'm sure you're, you know, who you're right. aware of, you know, has made it his personal work and his life work to basically go get these Magnitsky sanctions. But it's not like anyone's ever doing anything about it. Even Angela Merkel in the fallout of Navalny murder, while she, you know, made statements that this was terrible, and while intelligence, you know, confirmed that this was in fact Novichok, the poison, and that they believed with high confidence that, you know, Putin and Russian intelligence was behind this, it's not like there's a true punishment from this. You saw this, of course, in the murder of or poisoning of Skripal, and you know, and the genesis of this is 2006 with Alexander Litvinenko, where here a former KGB FSB spy defects to London and is poisoned by polonium, basically nuclear radiation that could have only come from essentially, you know, Russian intelligence and Putin, and nobody took action. And so what these authoritarian leaders are learning, and even look at, you know, the poisoning of Kim Jong-il's brother,
right.
You know, is that while this behavior might garner newspaper headlines and might, you know, get world leaders to condemn these actions, there's actually no true punishment for these crimes. And, you know, even in the aftermath of the Navalny death, and Putin was, you know, interviewed by this, you know, you go, oh, did you poison him? And he goes, absolutely not. He goes, well, but he is a traitor, and treason is the highest crime, and treason is a crime that should be punishable by death. So, I mean,
he admitted it. He absolutely admitted
right.
it. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, in his roundabout way, he flat out admitted it. So, I mean, and so what we're seeing and is, do we believe that Saudi Arabia and MBS thought that there was going to be a bug inside that consulate that was going to know all the details of this, on top of his fiance waiting outside for him, on top of him leaving his computer and devices with her, on top of all the surveillance footage that Turkey was able to gather to find the body double and the investigation to uncover that they had ordered 70 pounds of meat, literally, in the minutes that followed his murder, to go burn his body at the consul general's home in a tandoor oven. Of course, Saudi Arabia was not anticipating that. But I do believe that they felt that they could get away with it. And, you know, and if you look at their relationship with the Trump administration, I mean, Trump has publicly come out and said, you know, I'm not jeopardizing our relationship or the weapon sales or the billions of dollars in business, you know, to take action against this crime. And in Bob Woodward's book, Caught on Audio Tape, Trump, you know, bragged that he saved MBS's ass. So clearly there was a high level decision made, regardless of them getting caught, that they believed that they could get away with it. And they have.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. Then we'll be right back with more of a discussion with Brian Fogel.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital.
Crow portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
Brian, I want to ask you about the access that the Turks gave you. And I'm wondering two things. One is how difficult was it to get that? And why do you think they did that at the end of the day?
Look, they're gaining that trust of the Turkish government, where ultimately, you know, the only way to have gotten those interviews clearly was the president, you know, giving his blessing to his chief prosecutor and to, he's the Bill Barr Department of Justice and his forensic examiners and his spokesperson, his official spokesperson, who's considered the second most powerful man in Turkey, Ferhatun Altun, to discuss this matter. And you can look, you know, far and wide, and none of these guys have ever sat for an interview in regards to this case before.
Right.
Not only that, the vast majority of what's in that film, from all that, all those photos that they took inside the consulate, the consul generals, and the police footage is still unreleased, as well as the transcript. And we have, you know, they ultimately provided me with the 37-page transcript, and that's not in the hands of CNN or the BBC or any news source other than, you know, intelligence operations that they provided that to. So, you know, this was a very, very long process of building trust. And you can ask yourself, okay, well, what's Turkey's political intentions? What were they gaining by this? And I don't have the answer to that. And of course, Turkey has their own human rights issues, journalists jailed. Just last week, there's a story that they've, you know, imprisoned, I think, 186 people for life in the coup attempt in 2016. But in this case, in this matter, Turkey has been and still is on the right side of history, on the right side of this matter. And so to me, I made a very, I made a bargain with the Turks in saying that, listen, I am a truth teller. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I'm here to shed light on this story. I'm not here to disparage Turkey. That's not the film I'm making. And if you guys trust me and allow me to have this access, I'm going to do my best to bring this murder and atrocity into a cinematic art form, and hopefully to shed light on the story behind this story. And, they agreed. And I spent, for every day that I would get to shoot, you know, in Istanbul, there was another 10 days of meetings in that sort of trust building. And that is kind of how the access was gained and the trust that ensued, that, you know, Turkey was trusting me, I was trusting them, and this story was important to both of us.
So, Brian, you mentioned earlier that your previous film, Icarus, actually generated a reaction, right? It led the International Olympic Committee to ban Russia from the 2018 Winter Olympics. Are you hoping that this film generates some sort of reaction that gets the United States to finally bring some justice to what happened here?
You know, listen, the timing, the release of this film, in some ways is really great, because had it released, essentially during the Trump administration, while it would have shown, the Trump administration's desire not to hold Saudi Arabia accountable, despite both the Senate and House of Representatives passing legislation, to block weapon sales to the kingdom, putting forward bills to enact sanctions against Saudi Arabia for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. All of these measures essentially were vetoed by the Trump administration. And in the film,
I intentionally didn't want to create a bipartisan film. I wasn't trying to create a film where, you know, 47% of, you know, voters in the United States were going to go, oh, this is propaganda. And so, you know, to that extent, the facts are the facts. And the handful of voices that do comment on the Trump administration's decisions are, you know, his advocates. It's Rand Paul. It's Bob Corker. It's Lindsey Graham. You know, I didn't use Democratic voices. But, you know, Biden has come forward very publicly. He even made a statement on October 2nd, the second anniversary of Jamal's assassination, that if elected president, he would work to hold Saudi Arabia accountable, that he would reexamine the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And so in many ways, I think the release of the film, you know, January 8th across VOD is a perfect timing as Biden comes into office to remind, you know, people of this murder, of this relationship, and perhaps have a different outcome. I don't think it's about quote unquote justice for Jamal. We know that MBS is not leaving power, but, you know, there's a lot of positives that can come from this. And I believe that if there's enough pressure put on the Saudi administration, women's rights activists such as Lujan al-Hatoul, who is facing a 20-year sentence right now, simply for speaking up for women's rights in her country, literally why she's facing, she's on trial, has been tortured in prison, and they're asking for 20 years. Her crime is basically saying that women should have a right, whether or not they want to wear a full burqa and cover themselves in public, and women should have a right to leave their home without the consent of a male 18 years of older in their house, the guardian system. For that, she's looking to spend 20 years of prison in prison. So there are things that can be done with enough pressure that people like Lujan al-Hatoul or Assam al-Zamal, the economist, or Raif Badawi, if he is still indeed alive, which we don't know. these sort of activists and political prisoners could be set free on top of Omar's brothers that sit in jail for 2 years without charges, having been tortured, his friends who sit in prisons without charges, and, you know, the over 800 beheadings that took place in the kingdom last year. And according to many human rights organizations, the majority of these beheadings were activists under the age of 25 who dared to send a tweet, who dared to attend a protest or to say anything that was not in love and support of Mohammed bin Salman.
Ryan, I want to ask you a couple of specific questions about the film. And the first is, I think the film actually makes news in a number of ways. And one of the ways is to explain why this happened and why it happened when it did, which I think a lot of people were scratching their heads about, right? How did Jamal Khashoggi go from journalist and critic and reformer to dangerous dissident? Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think that is newsworthy.
You know, what you see is, you know, in Jamal Khashoggi, when he was murdered, he was 60 years old. And this was a man who was educated in the United States, who was fluent in English, and had spent the majority of his life essentially working as a quote-unquote journalist for the Saudi royal family. He owned a place in Washington, Virginia, long, long before he went into self-exile and left the kingdom in the year before his death. So this was truly a guy who, you know, who grew up or, you know, who was educated in the West, who had seen how democracies work, who saw how, you know, there could be a parliamentary system, and who loved his country. And even though he had spent most of his life essentially working as a liaison, you know, slash journalist, I guess almost lobbyist for the kingdom, he was not against the royal family. And as MBS took power, what Jamal saw was that the forward-facing appearance of MBS was as this great reformer, as this great young leader, as this great crown prince that was going to lead his country into the future and his vision 2030 and open up Saudi Arabia to tourism and help bring movies to Saudi Arabia and music and open up some freedoms that the people didn't have before. But at the same time behind this, what Jamal saw, especially as an insider, was this crackdown that he had never experienced in his life. You know, be it the crackdown at the Ritz-Carlton, where I believe this was, I can't remember, it was in 2017. And
2017, late, yeah.
Yeah, where MBS basically rounds up, you know, all of his, you know, friends and family and the wealth in the country and shakes them down and tortures them and, you know, for money. And basically, it's a mafia operation of people who were at that Ritz there. Some of them are still there, basically going, you know, I'm the boss. You can give me half. Or what Jamal was experiencing in that kingdom, whether it was through Saad al-Qahtani, his enforcer, or others, basically going, don't speak, don't write, don't tweet, shut up. And so as he's watching, you know, these big lobbyists bring MBS onto the world stage, and here's MBS in America appearing in a suit and meeting with Bill Gates and President Obama, or, you know, Obama and Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and others. What he's seeing in his country is a fear that he had never experienced before, that basically people were truly silenced. And rather than be silenced, Jamal decided to choose self-exile. And he comes to Washington, gets a job with the Washington Post, and he's finally, first time in his life, free to write his opinions. And what he is writing is essentially, I love my country. I like Mohammed bin Salman. I like the royal family. But I believe that if you're going to be a great reformer, you can't just reform in one place. You have to also be open to freedom of thought, freedom of opinion, and allow others to have a voice in leadership. And for this, he was murdered.
Yeah. Let me also ask, you know, the film suggests that the murder might have been viewed from Riyadh on a video teleconference and perhaps even directed from Riyadh. And I'm wondering, is that a circumstantial case based on the room that was chosen for the murder, or is there stronger evidence for that in the Turkish transcripts or from other sources?
Well, amazingly enough, and there is a lot of things that, you know, in the sensationalism of the story that Turkey did not disclose. And part of the transcript that I have actually contains a lot of pieces essentially in the days leading up to the murder. And one of the things that the Saudis do is 2 days before they murder Jamal, they literally send a technology, expert entourage to sweep the consulate for bugs. And somehow they do not find the single bug in the consulate. And that bug was in the media room. And you see this photos of this in the film. And the reason why that room was chosen was it was the only room within the consulate that had a secure video connection and secure way to communicate back to Riyadh. And so I guess the choice was made that, hey, if there was a bunch of bugs or whatever that was, they'd probably be found. But if there was just one and if there were sensitive communications, this was the room it should be in. And that, of course, turned out to be the room that Jamal was murdered in. In the transcript that I obtained after he is murdered, right before they go to dismember his body, the transcript basically goes dark for about an hour and a half. And while I don't know this to be the case or true, what I was essentially told or was implied
was as they dismembered Jamal, they made a call back to Riyadh to show Riyadh, whether that was Saad al-Qahtani or MBS, that, you know, Jamal was in fact murdered and dismembered. And then there is a part in that transcript, which, you know, I think is makes anybody's heart drop, is as they're removing the bags, the body bags from the room. I think it was Mutreb said there was a one of the bags contained apparently his hands in it. Yeah. He said, "No, no, no, leave that bag for me. Fingerprints." And what I was told and what was that implied was that they brought his hands and perhaps his head back to Saudi.
And you mentioned earlier rendition, and there's some folks who say this was a rendition gone wrong, right? That the idea was to take him back to Saudi Arabia and something went terribly wrong. Is that your assessment, or is your assessment that it was a planned murder all along?
The murder of Jamal was 100% a planned murder. I mean, you don't send 15 men, including the head of the, you know, a forensics guy who performs autopsies with a kit and a bone saw to Istanbul if you're not planning to murder him. They injected him with sedatives, and apparently they were literally embalming him while he was alive so that the blood would coagulate and circulate through his body in his dying moments with a coagulant and what you use when you embalm somebody. So, I mean, you don't send a team like that to carry out a rendition. So, I mean, clearly there was a plan to murder him. They had scoped out multiple places as to where they were going to bring the body. And there's parts of the transcript that talk about, you know, where they can go. They had looked at the Belgrade forest. They had looked at a farm, and this had become, you know, this was part of the Turkish investigation, and apparently ultimately decided on the consul general's house, because there was a tandoor oven there that they had serviced just in like the couple days leading up to his murder to make sure that it would burn at whatever the degree was, and that they then ordered 70 pounds of meat to apparently burn his body with the meat so it wouldn't leave traces of evidence. So the idea that this was a rendition, I don't believe, not even for 5 seconds, that there was going to be a rendition. I mean, they even brought a guy among their kill team to be a body double, and we see him put on a fake beard and literally walk out the consulate and dump Jamal's clothes that he had been wearing in a public place near the Blue Mosque, and then continue on his business as usual in the surveillance footage. So under what auspices was there a rendition ever planned when these people are in place and you even have disguises to make them look like Jamal?
Right. Brian, you have been fantastic with your time. I just have one more question for you, and we're running out of time, so we need to be quick here. I'm just wondering if you find it all ironic that the main source of information that you use to nail MBS and the Saudi perpetrators here was collected by a Turkish intelligence operation, that the world knowing the truth here and your film outlining it in great detail was the result of the Turks spying on the Saudis in a very significant way. I'm just wondering how you think about that.
Meaning, was this a Turkish bug? Is that really your question?
No, my question is, I just wonder how you think about the fact that we know all of this, right, because the Turks were spying on the Saudis, and just how you think about that.
Well, listen, I think what we know about intelligence operations around the world is that they are intelligence operations. We don't know until we know, right? And usually, whether it is, you know, Snowden letting us know, you know, what the NSA was doing, or It's disclosures that come years down the line, you know, when intelligence data can be released. What we do know is that, you know, nations and countries wish to spy on each other. And most of the time, you know, do so without disclosure. Clearly, you know, Turkey and Saudi Arabia have had tense relations. And I think Turkey's holding Saudi Arabia accountable in this and basically disclosing what happened and the details of this murder, you know, was truly because Turkey understood that Saudi Arabia was trying to frame them for this murder. Right. And so, I mean, Erdogan and his administration to understand that you would come onto Turkish soil, murdered someone in such a capacity on Turkish soil in their own consulate, thwarted the investigation, and then were going to frame the murder on Turkey. As I saw it in meeting with, you know, countless Turkish officials, there was no money, no ransom, nothing that was going to be paid, you know, to make this go away. And Saudi Arabia, one of the stories that I heard was in the days after the murder, you know, Turkey was basically, you know, going to Saudi intelligence and to the king and going, hey, guys, we have proof that Jamal was murdered. We know you murdered him. We have the audio. We have the surveillance footage. We know what happened. You guys need to confess. And if you don't confess, we're going to confess for you. And Saudi Arabia apparently went, ha, 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 whatever. You know, you don't have anything. And they then said, we do, and you should come to Istanbul. So apparently Saudi Arabia sent an entourage to Istanbul. They played the Saudis the audio and said to them, look, you're going to confess. You know, I don't know the timeline they gave them. The next day, the next 48 hours, whatever it is, or we're going to confess for you. And and so Turkey sharing this information with the world is the only reason why we truly know what happened. And I think it was a brave choice by Turkey to do this, because clearly, you know, had they kept this silenced, I can only imagine there could have been, you know, a lot of bribes paid, a lot of, you know, various economic aid for Turkey, a lot of, you know, political ties reestablished. And the decision by Turkey and Erdogan was no. It's more important for us to bring this story forward.
The film is The Dissident. The filmmaker is Brian Fogel. Brian, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Look, it's an honor to be speaking with you, and I hope audiences will go and see it. You know, I did a lot of work to craft the film into a thriller, into a theatrical cinematic thriller, and so despite the the brutality of this murder, I really wanted to craft a film that kept viewers on the edge of their seats in hope of not only learning, but wanting to take action and bring about change for so many that have been suffering in Saudi Arabia. And also, Hatice Cengiz, who loved Jamal, his family, and Omar Abdulaziz, who, you know, to this day, his brothers and friends sit imprisoned simply for knowing him.
Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice talking to you, Michael.
That was Brian Fogel. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. This show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Jake Rosen, Paulina Smolinski, and Ariana Freeman. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS Audio.
Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcast starting May 8th. Access episodes early and ad-free with 48 Hours Plus on Apple Podcasts starting May 1st.